This is VOA 1, the hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Anna Mateo and Brian Lynn. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Anna Mateo.
A few coins found in rural areas of the United States, including the state of Rhode Island, may help solve one of the oldest murder mysteries. The murderer in this story is an English pirate who became the world's most wanted criminal. His crime? He attacked and robbed a ship carrying Muslims traveling home to India from Mecca. The pirate then escaped capture by posing as a slave trader. It is a new history of a nearly perfect crime, Jim Bailey told the Associated Press. He is an amateur historian who found a 17th century Arabian coin in Middletown, Rhode Island. That ancient coin is one of the oldest ever found in North America. And it could explain how pirate Captain Henry Every disappeared from history. Here is the story. On September 7th, 1695, a pirate ship named Fancy, under Every's command, captured the Ganji E. Savai. That ship belonged to Indian Emperor Aurangzeb. At that time, the Indian Emperor was one of the most powerful men in the world. Aboard the ship were Muslims returning from Mecca and tens of millions of dollars worth of gold and silver. Historical records say Captain Every and his men tortured and killed the men and raped the women aboard the Indian ship. Then they escaped to the Bahamas, a safe place for pirates at that time. When word of the crimes reached English King William III, he set a large price for the capture of the pirates. Today, Bailey said, if you Google First Worldwide Manhunt, it comes up as Every. Everyone, he added, was looking for the pirates at the time. Until now, historians only knew that Every eventually sailed to Ireland in 1696 and disappeared. But Bailey said the coins he and others have found prove that the pirate and his crew had first come to the American colonies. They used the coins for day-to-day expenses during their escape. While using his metal detector at Sweetberry Farm, Bailey got a signal. He dug down and found a darkened, dime-sized silver coin. At first, he thought it was either a Spanish coin or one made by the Massachusetts Bay Colony. However, after a close look, he got very excited. He saw Arabic text on the coin. He said to himself, "Oh my God." Research confirmed that the coin was made in 1693 in Yemen. Since Bailey's discovery, others have found 15 more Arabian coins from the same time period. One coin was found in North Carolina, where records show some of Every's men first landed. Another coin was found in 2018 at a farm in Connecticut. Bailey said Captain Every was able to hide by posing as a slave trader. On his way to the Bahamas, Bailey explained, the pirate even stopped at the French island of Reunion to get some black captives so he would look the part. Other little-known records show the pirates left the Fancy and used a ship called the Seaflower to sail along the eastern coastline. It arrived with some slaves in 1696 in Newport, Rhode Island, then a center of the North American slave trade. Bailey, who has a degree in anthropology from the University of Rhode Island, published his findings in the research publication American Numismatic Society. Jim's research is impeccable, said Kevin McBride, a professor of archaeology at the University of Connecticut. It's really a pretty interesting story, he said. Hollywood thinks so too. A movie about Captain Every will be released by Sony Pictures in early 2022. For Bailey, it's always been about the thrill of the hunt, not about the money, he said. The only thing better than finding these objects is the long-lost stories behind them. I'm Ana Mateo.
A new study suggests that long periods in space can cause the human heart to shrink. The study, by a team of American researchers, comes as the U.S. makes plans to build a long-term base on the moon and prepares to send astronauts to Mars. Part of the study was based on the experiences of retired astronaut Scott Kelly. The U.S. space agency NASA says that during his career, Kelly spent more time in space than any other American astronaut. One of Kelly's stays aboard the International Space Station lasted 340 days. Researchers from the University of Texas's Southwestern Medical Center, UT Southwestern in Dallas, examined physical data collected during Scott's long stay aboard the ISS. The goal was to learn the effects of weightlessness on heart health and performance. The team found that during Kelly's stay in space, the left ventricle of his heart shrank about 0.74 grams per week. Dr. Benjamin Levine is a professor of internal medicine at UT Southwestern. He was the leader of the research. In a statement, he explained that because of the conditions in space, the heart does not have to work as hard to pump blood uphill from the feet. Over time, this can cause shrinkage. The heart has to work harder to keep blood flowing as it works against gravity, Levine explained. This permits the heart to keep its size and perform effectively. In an effort to keep their muscles and organs healthy in space, astronauts are required to perform different kinds of exercises throughout their stay. Reductions in heart size are also seen in patients who spend long periods in bed because they are lying flat and the heart does not have to work as hard to pump. In the astronaut experience, Levine said that even though the heart is good at adapting to changes in gravity, the exercise Kelly got was not enough to keep the heart unchanged. Both the impact of gravity as well as the adaptive response to exercise play a role, he told the American Heart Association's Circulation Journal report. And we were surprised that even extremely long periods of low-intensity exercise did not keep the heart muscle from shrinking, Levine added. Full results of the study recently appeared in the AHA's publication Circulation. A second part of the study examined data from a long-distance swimmer who spent nearly a year trying to cross the Pacific Ocean. The swimmer, Benoit Lecomte, was chosen because he swam more than 2,800 kilometers over 159 days. Lecomte made it about a third of the way across the Pacific before deciding to stop because of bad weather and damage to a boat following him. Levine says long-distance swimming has similar effects to weightlessness because water pressure works against the force of gravity. The study showed that during Lecomte's swim, his left heart ventricle shrank about 0.72 grams per week. The researchers noted that both Kelly and Lecomte had nearly the same heart shrinkage level, even though Lecomte exercised much more, swimming an average of 6 hours a day. Kelly spent 1 to 2 hours a day exercising in space. Levine said he was somewhat surprised by this finding. But he noted that endurance swimming is not considered a high-intensity exercise. So the health benefits from swimming were likely outweighed by the heart not having to work as hard to pump blood uphill. Even with the changes in both men, Levine said the overall heart function remained good throughout the study period. I think this is encouraging for long-duration spaceflight, he added. It shows that even after a year in space, the heart adapts relatively well. The researchers say further study will be needed to confirm the latest findings as scientists attempt to create guidelines for future astronauts expected to spend long periods in space. Levine is prepared to lead some of those studies. He has worked with NASA on several projects in the past, and the space agency recently awarded him $3.8 million to be used over the coming years to study the effects of space travel on the heart. I'm Brian Lynn.
To help protect yourself against the new coronavirus, wash your hands for 20 seconds with soap and water before you eat, after using the toilet, and after touching anything many other people touch, like a seat on a public bus. If you cannot wash your hands with soap and water, use an alcohol-based hand sanitizer that contains at least 60% alcohol. Taking these steps can help prevent not only the new coronavirus disease, but also colds, flu, and other viruses. For more information, visit the following websites: the World Health Organization at www.who.int, or the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention at www.cdc.gov.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. We continue the story of President George Herbert Walker Bush. He was elected the 41st President of the United States in 1988. George H.W. Bush was president when the Cold War ended between the United States and the Soviet Union. The Cold War had lasted more than 40 years. Both sides were heavily armed with nuclear weapons. People worried that one wrong move could lead to the end of the world. But by the late 1980s, the world was changing. The Soviet Union was dying. On November 9, 1989, East Germany opened the Berlin Wall for the first time since it had been built. The wall had divided communist East Germany from democratic West Germany since 1961. Citizens and soldiers together soon began tearing it down. Tensions continued to ease as communist rule in most of the former Soviet republics ended by the early 1990s. 15 republics had belonged to the Soviet Union. By the end of 1991, most had declared their independence. They became a loosely formed group called the Commonwealth of Independent States. Countries that had considered the United States their enemy now looked to it to lead the way to peace and, they hoped, prosperity. As the Soviet Union was dying, President Bush repeatedly negotiated with Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev. One of those meetings took place in the spring of 1990 in the United States. It led to an agreement calling for both sides to destroy most of their chemical weapons. The two leaders also agreed to increase trade relations. The American and Soviet presidents met in Moscow in July 1991. There, they signed the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, known as START I. This treaty called for both sides to reduce their numbers of long-range nuclear weapons. They promised to cut the number by about one-third over 7 years. START I became the first agreement between the two powers to order cuts in existing supplies of nuclear weapons. In September 1991, President Bush said the United States would remove most of its short-range nuclear weapons from service. He also said the United States would destroy many of them. The next month, the Soviets announced that they would do the same. On December 25th of that year, Mikhail Gorbachev resigned as president as the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics came to an end.
Compatriots, due to the situation which has evolved as a result of the formation of the Commonwealth of Independent States, I hereby discontinue my activities at the post of President of the USSR.
6 months earlier, Russians had chosen Boris Yeltsin as the first democratically elected leader of Russia. When the Soviet Union collapsed, he became the most important leader of the former republics. President Bush and President Yeltsin signed another Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, START II, in January 1993.
Fellow citizens, last night I ordered U.S. military forces to Panama. No president takes such action lightly.
One of George Bush's military actions as president was to send troops into Panama in December 1989. They captured the country's leader, General Manuel Noriega. The United States had charged Noriega with drug trafficking. He had also refused to honor election results that showed another candidate winning the presidency. President Bush said he also sent troops to the Central American nation to protect the 35,000 Americans living there. The American troops easily defeated Noriega's forces. He was taken to the United States, where he was tried, found guilty, and sent to prison for many years. The United States then supported the presidency of Guillermo Endara, the winner of the election in Panama.
Five months ago, Saddam Hussein started this cruel war against Kuwait. Tonight, the battle has been joined.
In August 1990, Iraq invaded its neighbor, Kuwait. The United Nations Security Council passed a resolution threatening war on Iraq unless it withdrew from Kuwait. The Council set a deadline of January 15, 1991. But Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein refused. The United States and other nations were receiving much of their oil from Kuwait and neighboring Saudi Arabia. President Bush succeeded in forming a coalition with 38 other countries against Iraq. The purpose was to free Kuwait and protect Saudi Arabia against a possible Iraqi invasion.
This military action, taken in accord with United Nations resolutions and with the consent of the United States Congress, follows months of constant and virtually endless diplomatic activity on the part of the United Nations, the United States, and many, many other countries. Arab leaders sought what became known as an Arab solution, only to conclude that Saddam Hussein was unwilling to leave Kuwait. Others traveled to Baghdad in a variety of efforts to restore peace and justice. Our Secretary of State, James Baker, held an historic meeting in Geneva, only to be totally rebuffed. This past weekend, in a last-ditch effort, the Secretary General of the United Nations went to the Middle East with peace in his heart. His second such mission, and he came back from Baghdad with no progress at all in getting Saddam Hussein to withdraw from Kuwait.
Coalition forces began an air war against Iraq on January 17, 1991. They bombed Iraqi targets in Iraq and Kuwait. On February 23rd, the Iraqis set fire to hundreds of Kuwaiti oil wells.
It looks like what I envisioned hell would look like. The country of Kuwait is burning.
The coalition had the long and difficult task of putting those fires out. On February 24th, the Allied ground war began as part of the operation known as Desert Storm. That ground war lasted just 100 hours. Saddam Hussein withdrew his forces from Kuwait, but he was still in control of his own country. Years later, some Americans continued to criticize the Bush administration for not trying to oust the Iraqi leader. They believe that Bush should have sent forces to capture Baghdad, the Iraqi capital. After the war ended, Kurds in northern Iraq rebelled against Saddam Hussein. So did Shiite Muslims in southern Iraq. The Iraqi government crushed both uprisings. The defeated Kurds fled to Iran and Turkey and into the mountains of northern Iraq. President Bush ordered American troops to help give humanitarian aid to the refugees. The troops established refugee camps for the Kurds. As time passed, Iraqi soldiers and aircraft continued to attack the Kurds in the north and the Shiites in the south. Coalition forces led by the United States established no-fly zones barring Iraqi aircraft over northern and southern Iraq. Coalition planes enforced these no-fly zones in the years that followed. By late 1992, drought and conflict had caused widespread suffering in Somalia.
I want to talk to you today about the tragedy in Somalia and about a mission that can ease suffering and save lives. Every American has seen the shocking images from Somalia. The scope of suffering there is hard to imagine. Already, over 250,000 people have died in the Somali famine. In the months ahead, five times that number, 1.5 million people could starve to death.
The violence and the collapse of the government were keeping many Somalis from receiving food and other aid.
The security situation has grown worse. The UN has been prevented from deploying its initial commitment of troops. In many cases, food from relief flights is being looted upon landing. Food convoys have been hijacked, aid workers assaulted, ships with food have been subject to artillery attacks that prevented them from docking. There is no government in Somalia. Law and order have broken down. Anarchy prevails. One image tells the story. Imagine 7,000 tons of food aid literally bursting out of a warehouse on a dock in Mogadishu while Somalis starve less than a kilometer away because relief workers cannot run the gauntlet of armed gangs roving the city.
President Bush, in the last year of his term, sent American troops to Somalia to assist in the aid efforts. But the following year, in October of 1993, 18 American soldiers on a raid were killed in a battle in Mogadishu. More than 80 others were wounded. That failed operation would haunt the American military for years to come. The events of that day were the basis for the book and movie Black Hawk Down. In December of 1992, as Bush was about to leave office, he and the leaders of Canada and Mexico signed the North American Free Trade Agreement. NAFTA called for removing taxes and other barriers to trade in North America. Some Americans accused Bush of sacrificing American jobs to lower-paid workers in Mexico by supporting NAFTA. Others praised him for supporting the agreement, which still had to pass Congress. But by the time it did, George Bush was no longer president. He had lost his campaign for a second term. In November of 1992, he lost the election to the Democratic governor of Arkansas, Bill Clinton.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.